Well, first of all, I want to thank everyone for being here this afternoon. It's a tough time to speak, but it's even a tougher time to listen. So I appreciate you being here this afternoon. I also want to thank 21st Street. I always enjoy being here. And as Richard said yesterday, I'd be happy to be here even without being a speaker. But nonetheless, I do appreciate the opportunity, and the hospitality and the food has just been great. And I appreciate the sisters for providing that. You know, this is one of those topics that tends to grow, not on you necessarily, but grow as you go through it. Yesterday, I stepped over to the house to study a little while on this, and I thought I would reduce it, and I came up with six new slides. Last night, I went home, back to Wayne and Mary's, and thought I'd reduce it again, and came up with about three more. So it just keeps growing because it's a topic that, while the scriptures themselves, I think, are fairly simple and clear, the application tends to be very difficult. Because there are so many scenarios, and I think perhaps as we look at this topic, one of the things we need to keep in mind is that we are up against an environment where the religious world is doing so much with what they would deem the Lord's money that even what we do perhaps outside of what we should do ends up looking like nothing. And so by comparison, again, it may seem very trivial or trite to discuss some of the things that we're discussing, but I want us to, again, remember that the issue is not what is going on in the religious world, it's what the Bible says. Also, I think some of the issues that probably we will discuss this afternoon on a practical level come because of our affluent society. Maybe 100 years ago or so, you didn't have the problem of church buildings and what they could or couldn't have in them because our brother had no money, we had little cracker box buildings or storefronts. Those were not issues. But as we have become more affluent, obviously, again, we have trappings that come along with that affluency. You go to third world countries, Africa, and many of these issues that we discuss ad nauseum are not even issues because there's no context for discussion of that. A few years ago, Delmer and I were over in Tanzania and also Kenya, and we did a study on the use of the Lord's money, and we did kind of an exhaustive study, and I'm not going to try to give an exhaustive study this morning or this evening of the treasury. I think you can go back into the Old Testament and see that the Lord's people have typically always had a treasury. But what I want to look at this evening is the New Testament passages, and I want to look at basically these points. Number one, is a local congregation authorized to gather funds? And I think, again, we're probably sure that that's the case. How is the church to collect these funds? Number three, what may these funds be used for? And number five, what, if any, restrictions are placed on a congregation? And then the 21st Street congregation asked me to discuss some practical considerations, not the least of which were kitchens and fellowship halls, building elaborate or fancy buildings, and then, of course, some common blunders that perhaps congregations make in the use of the Lord's money. So we're going to try to deal with all of these issues as best as we can. I'm sure we will not satisfy all of the questions, and again, probably never will. But nonetheless, I do want to make a stab at least these points. Now, first of all, in our preliminary considerations, I want us again to remember that we are people of the book. You know, whether we're talking about the marriage question, as we did this morning, or whether we're talking about this topic, we are people of the book. And so it really doesn't matter what the religious world thinks. It really doesn't matter what context we are in and the comparative analysis we might make with what other churches or denominations are doing, so to speak. But we are people of the book, and we want to demand scriptural authority for the things that we do. And I think when we get this point, again, squarely in our minds, it will help us, again, take some of the emotion out of the topics that perhaps we will discuss today. Also, if the Lord's church is authorized to collect funds, then we also need to keep in mind that we are simply stewards of those funds, and they are the Lord's funds. So while we are stewards, while we are people who work with those funds in a scriptural way, ultimately they are the Lord's funds and ultimately should go to His glory. Well, let's look at the authorization in the New Testament for the gathering of funds. Now, many times when we think of the collection, and I hear this many times on the Lord's Day when we take up the collection, many times the individual who is facilitating in that will speak of 1 Corinthians 16 and the needy saints, and that's exactly right. Now, as we'll notice, there are other reasons the church can take up a collection, but let's start with needy saints. We know that the church of the first century took care of its own. Not long after Pentecost, we find that there were troubles and trials and difficulties that set in, and probably partly because people had come into Jerusalem from all over the known world, They were converted. They stayed around. They ran out of finances and funds. And so the church then, or the Christians, began to help one another. And we find that the apostles were overseeing the collection and distribution of these funds. In fact, at one point, by the time you get to Acts 6, they are so overwhelmed with this that they set aside seven specific individuals to take care of, for example, the distribution of funds to the widows. But nonetheless, at the beginning, the apostles did indeed oversee the collection and the distribution of funds for the needy saints. And so in Acts 2:45, we find that many sold their possessions and gave them this money, brought the money to the apostles. In Acts 4, verse 34, we find that even lands and houses were being sold and were brought to, again, the apostles, and then those proceeds were distributed as each one had need. Now, I might make the side comment that the early church was not communistic. It was communal, but it was not communistic. And there is a political difference, I think, in those two issues. But nonetheless, they took care of one another. They took care of their own. Later on, of course, in the book of Acts, we find the prophecy of natural disasters and other hardships that soon would come upon the church. And so then we find the disciples, as they looked forward to the needs that soon would come upon them, determined to send relief to the congregations, in this case in Acts 11:27, to the churches of those who dwelt in Judea. And so, again, we see this pattern already beginning in the book of Acts, that the Christians of the first century were benevolent, they cared for their own, they, again, looked to the needs of those that within their ranks had these needs. Paul, as he begins his basic career, if you will, in preaching, is commanded, or at least commissioned, to remember the poor. And of course, Paul had no problem with that. That was something he was very willing and desirous to do. And so when, again, we think of the collection, and there are other passages we can mention, but when we think of the collection, we obviously think first and foremost, or at least many times, of the needy saints. Now, we'll talk a little bit toward the end of our presentation about what constitutes a needy saint, because that, I believe, can be abused and misused in the Lord's treasury. But also, again, in 1 Corinthians 16, the passage that we just mentioned, Paul writes to that church, and he says, "Now concerning the collection of the saints, as I am given orders to the churches of Galatia, even so do you." And so then, again, Paul, as he makes his missionary journeys, as he begins to gather these gifts, he wants them to lay something aside on the Lord's Day, as we do even today. We store that up for the needs that then are presented, whether they be the needy saints or, as we will notice, other needs that the church might have. Now, I also believe that there is a certain amount of authorization that one congregation has to assist another congregation. Now, we obviously know that we can assist needy saints within our own ranks. But in the previous passage in 1 Corinthians 16, we find this hint there, or this statement, that funds were being gathered by Paul from the Gentile churches in order to assist the Jewish churches. Again, this passage says this concerning the collection for the saints. And then Paul mentions the churches in Galatia. He also mentions, of course, that he would take these funds to Jerusalem, to the elders there, and he even invites someone from their ranks to come and, as it were, accompany him. And so all that was done would be obviously above board and in propriety. So there does seem to be a little a hint here, or a pattern, of one congregation helping another. Now, I want to throw this in because, again, this is perhaps an aside to my topic, but when we think about the mission of the church, and we'll notice this in a moment in more detail, and I hope that we'll make this more clear, but basically there are four basic functions of the church. The four functions are evangelism, the Great Commission, we fulfill that. Number two, taking care of the needy saints, as we've just noted. Number three, edification of the body. And then number four, of course, we're commanded to assembly. Hebrews 10:25, Acts 20 and 7, and so on and so forth. So now, we know that in at least one of these areas, in the area of the taking care of the needy saints, in 1 Corinthians 16, there was a certain amount of congregational cooperation. And again, Paul makes it sure that no autonomy is lost. Corinth decide how much they were going to give. They sent their own representatives to Jerusalem, apparently, with Paul. And so it would seem, again, that while there was cooperation, there was never a breach of autonomy or any problems along that line. Now, that led me to think about this as I was thinking about congregational cooperation and the money. And while cooperation is not really my topic, I did want us to throw this out and think about this. You know, again, many congregations cooperate in carrying out the mission of the church in the case of the relief of needy, Paul had gone to the church at Corinth, he had gone to the churches of Galatia, so on and so forth, and they had cooperated. Well, if indeed there is biblical authority to cooperate in the relief of needy saints, then it seems to me it would be logical that in the other facets of the church's work, there could be, under certain circumstances, cooperation as well. In fact, I think we practice this in our brotherhood. You know, evangelism, we help other congregations, perhaps send an evangelist to Africa or so on and so forth. Now, obviously, there are constraints and scriptural patterns that we use to do that, but there is a certain modicum of cooperation. Edification, how many times have we purchased Bibles for churches in perhaps other areas of the world? That's a process or a product of edification. And then, of course, the assembly of the saints. We know that the church is commanded to assemble, and so it would make sense to me that in any of these three categories on the right, if there are needs that are legitimate needs, a congregation A could help congregation B in the relief of those needs, just as it is able to help scripturally the relief of the needy, as the churches at Corinth did to the churches in Judea. But again, that's not really my topic per se, but I think it's an interesting consideration. Now, when we also think about the authorization for the use of funds, obviously, evangelism. In fact, really, evangelism probably should stand at the foremost point of our consideration when we think about the use of the church monies. Now, obviously, because we go to 1 Corinthians 16, and the context there is needy saints, many times we do think, I think, of needy saints first, but we have a great need to evangelize. And of course, that's what the book of Acts is really all about. Paul making his three missionary journeys and then the journey to Rome. The evangelism of the first century was evident in the first century. In fact, in Acts chapter 8, verse 4, it says they went everywhere preaching the word. Well, that was the individual members. But also there was a need to gather funds and to send preachers out to preach the gospel. Paul would make reference to this many times, for example, in Philippians chapter 4, to the church that arguably was his closest companions. In fact, at times, they seemed to be the only ones that sent aid to him. He thanks them. He thanks them for their sending him the funds and the monies that they had collected so that he might be able to support himself and others in preaching the gospel. Paul would argue to the Corinthians that while he did not take money for them, that he robbed other churches and took wages from them so that he might minister to them. And so obviously we see the Apostle Paul, while he did work at times, while he built tents, he did take money to do evangelism. And of course, that is a very scriptural use of the church's money. In fact, Paul, in arguing in 1 Corinthians 9 about rights that he had given up, he says, you know, even the Lord commanded that those who preach the gospel would live from the gospel. And so there is indeed this principle and, of course, this command for the churches to collect monies and to send others out, spread the gospel, take the gospel into all the world. And as one brother back home used to always say, and I thought it was a pretty good kind of a rule of thumb, not necessarily a law, but he said, you know, a congregation should have a local work going on. It would be great if they do something within their state and then something internationally as well. Now, some congregations are too small to be able to do too much than just evangelize or send out someone on a local level or on a part-time or helping level. But nonetheless, sending evangelists out is certainly a great responsibility and authorized duty of the church. Well, another reason that we find the early church gathering funds is for widows indeed. And again, while we could discuss the various qualifications of these widows indeed, and there were stringent qualifications. And by the way, these seemed to be ladies who were put on, as it were, a payroll, much as maybe a preacher or an evangelist would be. But nonetheless, they were to be supported if they met these qualifications. Now, the issue here, though, is that they had to meet these qualifications. And the church, as Paul will argue, was not to be burdened if they had family members that could care for them. Great discussion we could have on this, but the basic point is we see again the church in certain circumstances and under certain conditions were to be burdened or could be burdened with the help of the widows who were really widows and had no other way to support themselves. Well, preaching elders, and I don't particularly like that term, but I do believe it is scriptural. In fact, I believe that the early church had the authority and perhaps did take up collections along with or utilize their collection along with other things to support elders or leaders, the elders, who were, again, laboring in the word on a full-time basis. Paul, in 1 Timothy 5, in the same chapter where he addresses the issue of widows, indeed, says this in verse 17. He says, "Let the elders who rule well be counted worthy of double honor." Now, that perhaps is another way of saying given money, because he later on describes what that means. He says, especially those who labor in the word and doctrine. Then he goes on and he says, "For the scripture says, you shall not muzzle the ox while it is treads out the grain, and the laborer is worthy of his wages." So apparently in the early church, there were elders, there were leaders who dedicated themselves to the preaching of the gospel, to the strengthening of the church. They were doing it to such an extent that their physical needs needed to be met so they could keep up that level of service. And that is an authorized thing for the church to do. So, very quickly, in review, thus far, we have seen that the early church took up funds. They were authorized to gather collections for poverty-stricken saints, both at home and away. They were authorized to help other congregations. They were authorized to support preachers and evangelists of the gospel. They were authorized to support widows who met certain strict qualifications. And of course, they were authorized to support elders who labored in preaching. Well, again, how shall we gather these funds? And I know a lot of these topics we're hitting this morning probably should be a study in and of themselves, but we're trying to give a cursory overview of the basics of the use of the Lord's money and some practical things that we might learn from that. But how was the church authorized to gather funds? Well, let's go back to the book of Acts. Again, it is always voluntary. Those who brought money to the apostles, selling goods or bringing money they already had, did so on a voluntary basis. It was never a bill that the church sent to the members of the church. It was done on an individual voluntary basis. It was always done on the first day of the week. It was done as one had prospered. And of course, in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, Paul goes on to even speak of the attitude that we are to have in our giving, not grudgingly or of necessity, because he says God loves a cheerful giver. And so when we look at the way funds were gathered, it is so much different than what we see in the religious world today in the gathering of funds. Today, the religious world has all kinds of programs, all kinds of products that they sell in order to supplement or in order to fill the coffers of the church. That was never done in the first century. Much as in the time of Moses, when the tabernacle was being built, free will offerings were given, and the people, those who were truly converted, gave in abundance. And so then again, it was done in a voluntary fashion. You know, one time someone asked, well, you know, should I give until it hurts? Well, no, I think we should give until it feels good. Because really, we are to be giving out of a joyful, loving heart to the Lord, knowing that those funds hopefully will be used for the spread of the gospel and for the real, legitimate needs of the saints. And of course, that places a burden, doesn't it, upon the leaders of the church to make for sure that the funds that they are spending from those who do give are used in a way that is honest, that is scriptural, that is, again, above board in any fashion. And that way, the congregation can have confidence that their giving is indeed going toward what it is supposed to go toward. So here's some observations that we might make. Number one, money was always collected from members. It was never collected from non-Christians. The church does not go out into the world and sell candy bars. It does not go out into the world and do anything. It is an in-house operation, if you will. Money was always collected by free will offerings. It was never, again, a tax, so to speak. Money was never collected, though, by way of a business, a venture of any kind, whether that was selling something or renting something out. Money was never collected in that sense or in that way for the early church. Money was always collected for the Lord's work only. It was never collected for what we might deem today extracurricular activities. In other words, those four things, which we'll come back to in a moment. You know, the evangelization of the world, the edification of the saints, the feeding of the poor, and the assembly. Those are the things that I believe we are limited to in spending the funds. Well, let's talk about the authorized collections and how they parallel the mission of the church. In other words, again, we know that the church is to accomplish certain things. But, you know, when you look at what the church is to accomplish, and then you look at, again, the funds that we are authorized to collect, there's a parallel. They run along, as it were, on the same track because they are, again, they go hand in hand with one another. So let's talk about these four basic functions. Again, evangelization, edification, relief of its own, and, of course, assembly for worship. Now, let's go back to evangelization. First of all, we know that we are from the Great Commission to preach the gospel. We also know, as we've been given examples, and then also as we just know in general, that money was spent to send preachers like Paul and others out. We also know that the church is to be edified. In fact, 1 Corinthians 14 is all about edification. And of course, money can be spent in that process in, among other ways, the elders, who again labor in the word, and that's part of the edification as well as perhaps evangelization process. So I'm going to put the supported elders under the edification category. We also know, again, from Acts 2, 1 Corinthians 16, that money could be taken and given to needy saints. And we'll discuss again the definition of that perhaps in a moment. Now, that deals with three of the categories. Now, sometimes, and I want to spend just a moment on this, people ask, well, what about the assembly house? Is there any authorization for a church building? Because it seems so far removed, perhaps, at first glance, from these other categories. Well, let's think about this in a logical way. Again, three of these four functions obviously demand funds. In other words, you can't send out a preacher without having some funds available. You can't, of course, take care of needy saints without having some resources available. You can't, of course, support the edification process of a church without having some resources available. So, again, those three things, those three categories certainly require funds, and in my mind, that's probably the reason they are so clearly spoken of and regulated. Now, what then about the assembly of the saints? Well, you know, the assembly of the saints is sort of an interesting category because it might be possible in some circumstances to assemble as saints and not have any expense in and of itself. You know, for example, the early church met in homes. Perhaps there's a great advantage of that socially and, of course, spiritually. But nonetheless, it may be that the church in some locales would not have any expense in assembling. But now, what if that situation was that the church did not have a place to assemble? Well, I believe, as we'll notice in a minute, that the church is authorized to do what it takes to obey the command of assembly, in which case the assembly issue would be, allowed to have funds spent in that direction. And we'll talk more about this in just a second. We might look at it this way. Let's start back with the evangelization process. You know, a lot of times in our discussions, we talk about hermeneutics, we talk about specific authority, generic authority. So I kind of threw these little charts together to help me kind of think about this. But let's think about preaching the gospel. Now, of course, we know that we have specific authority to go. We know we have specific authority to preach, to send preachers, evangelists, so on and so forth. And then, of course, we believe that there are generic things or generic authority that allows us then to accomplish what God has commanded. If he says go, we have to go. But God allows us within the framework of our culture and our time and perhaps our finances to decide whether that's going to be planes, trains, or automobiles. He says preach. But, you know, again, within certain constraints, we have freedom to preach by word of mouth, by radio, by TV, or any number of other methods. And so we, again, have liberties even amongst these specific commands that God has given us. And of course, again, supporting preachers. Who that's going to be, God leaves up to the individual congregation as to who they will support, how much they're going to support. There are general guidelines. Those who preach the gospel need to be able to live from the gospel, but there's no specific amount of money that is mentioned. So those are generic things, again, that through wisdom, through circumstances, through leadership, we determine. But the point at the end of the day is that funds are needed for these events and funds are authorized. Well, let's talk about edification. Now, again, I mentioned a while ago that we were going to put elders who labor in the word under the edification process or under that category, and I think that works. But there are other things that in the edification process the church must do. It has to feed the flock. The elders were commanded that in Acts 20. Colossians 4 indicates that there were copies of Scripture that were circulated. And so, again, when you think about that, that's specific. But now, as to the copies of Scripture today, whether that would be a King James Version or a New King James Version or an ESV or whatever, that, again, falls under a generic authority. Feeding the flock. It might come in any number of ways. Topical lessons, expository lessons, so on and so forth. Elders who labor in the word, while they can be paid, the amount, so on and so forth, again, is under the category of generic authority. So the point, again, at the end of the day, once again, is that funds are needed for this category, and funds are authorized to both be collected and distributed to meet this particular mission of the church. Well, let's talk about the relief of its own. Needy saints, obviously, you have to have some resources for that. Widows indeed, if they're going to be on the payroll, so to speak, there has to be resources. Displaced saints, again, those will all fall under the general category of needy saints or the poor, but we have some general things that maybe aren't answered in the Scriptures, as in what exactly constitutes a needy saint. There's no exact list of qualifications such as there are with the widow indeed for a needy saint, because particulars may vary. Circumstances vary. Situations vary. Cultures vary. And so there is some wisdom and some generic authority that we have in doing this task of meeting the needs of the saints. So what about then the assembly? Now again, we've mentioned that those three previous categories all allow scripturally and require monies, and then we have the ability and the right to collect those monies and use them for that purpose. Well, that then addresses or comes then to this final point, and that is, can we have a church building? And the reason, again, I bring that up is because that's something that I have read some on, and people have asked me about that. And at first, you scratch your head and think, well, there's no church buildings in the Scriptures that I can see. Well, not directly, perhaps, but now we have specific authority, not only authority, but it's a command to assemble. We know we need to do that on the first day of the week. We know we have to do it in one undivided assembly. And to accomplish that, obviously, you have to have a place of assembly. Clint and I were talking earlier, by the way, and this is not my topic, but I wonder if perhaps this idea of specific and generic authority comes into the synagogue issue. You know, where's the authorization for a synagogue? Well, if people are to assemble, as Richard pointed out yesterday in his topic, and to have the law read to them, you have to have a place for that to occur. Now, it may be nothing more than a shade tree or an umbrella to keep the sun off, or it might be a building. But nonetheless, you have to have a place to assemble. Well, again, using the same logic that we use in how much to support a preacher or who to support or where to send him, it looks to me like in the assembly process we have a certain amount of liberty to decide where we're going to meet, perhaps what day or what time of the day, rather, we're going to meet, what kind of chairs we're going to purchase. Again, whether we're going to have a rented building or a purchased building, these all, I believe, would fall under generic authority, and while they perhaps are more nebulous than we would like, we use good stewardship as best we can to determine the generics under the categories of specifics. Well, that brings us to this point then, this evening, and that is God certainly authorizes obedience. So if God gives us a command, then obviously God is going to allow us to do what it takes to fulfill that command. That would be, in my view, logic 101. God is not, he's a God that wants his commands to be obeyed. And so if he gives us a command, then surely he's going to allow us to have the tools to take care of that command. Well, again, when we look at these categories, evangelism, relief of the needy, edification, we are authorized to meet those commands by the taking and the spending of monies. The assembly of the saints, no less a command. So why then would we not also be allowed to collect and spend monies in that category? Again, four categories of authorized church work, four categories of authorized collection
and spending. Well, let's very quickly hasten on, and let's talk about the tools that, again, are necessary or might be necessary to fulfill a command. You know, God does allow ownership of tools, and we'll explain that in a moment, the tools necessary to carry out a command. You know, Noah, I think, was authorized to have a hammer to build the ark, even though there's no hammer perhaps mentioned. However, God does not authorize poor stewardship, nor does he authorize the purchase of wrong tools or unauthorized tools. So let's look at the tool chest. Evangelism. The command is to send out evangelists. What are the tools? Well, you've got to have willing men. You've got to have transportation. You've got to have Bible tracts or Bibles or the supplies needed to get that man preaching. And again, there's no definitive list. But context, culture, situations, wisdom, generic authority will come into play, I believe, in determining what tools are necessary. And we need to be careful. Because sometimes, if you're like me, you like to collect tools that maybe are not quite necessary, both at home and, of course, in my preaching as well. Well, again, how much of the church is to be burdened with those tools? Well, obviously, a certain amount for the job to be done. Edification, or the command to the assemble, rather. We'll just turn to that. Again, this we assemble for edification. The tools there might be the support of elders. We have local teachers, a place for edification. We might need to have supplies, and I believe the church is authorized to, you know, have a PowerPoint projector or to make copies for the membership in the edification of the church. What about the care of its own? Well, again, we know we're authorized to spend money on the poor, but the tools that we use might vary from place to place. We're going to have food or supplies, maybe volunteers, and other things that would go in to the relief of those saints who, again, are needy. Well, the same, I believe, would be true with the command to assemble. The command, not forsaking the assembly, has to be carried out, but you have to have the tools to carry out the job. What are the tools? Well, they may vary from place to place. In Africa, we can, and sometimes do, meet under a tree. But now I doubt in Alaska or in the North Pole, if there are congregations there, which I don't think there is, that would be possible. So you see, those things are going to change from place to place. And again, I believe we're authorized to do what makes assembly possible. Is there wisdom that has to be used? Yes. Is there a definitive list that we can go to in the Scriptures? No. But nonetheless, if assembly is one of the four categories of the mission of the church, then like the other three, it seems that we are authorized as a congregation or congregations to supply those needs. So, when we look at the tool chest, let's think about this as we come now toward a more practical application. When we think about the factors in building a tool chest, I think there are three things we should keep in mind. Number one, the authority factor. We obviously don't want to violate any scripture. We do know there's generic authority or some liberty, but again, not all things that are lawful might be expedient. So that brings us then to the wisdom factor, where a congregation, under prayerful consideration with its leaders, will decide what is and is not to be perhaps part of their work. Now, different situations, different localities, all of these things are going to affect how we carry out the Lord's work. And I think there's some things we need to keep in mind. You know, for example, there are liberties in what God allows in the tool chest. You know, in one culture, it may require one thing, and another, you know, because of terrain or whatever. But again, they must never violate commands. Number two, the tools must be subordinate to the command, which is another way of saying the same thing. Preaching the Bible, obviously, for example, cannot be replaced by studying Tolstoy. We can't study Tolstoy in the church to replace the Bible, because that would be adding, again, technically speaking, a coordinate. Also, not all legitimate tools may be a good investment. You know, if a church needs, or let's say an individual, needs to do a project, and maybe all he needs is a claw hammer to do it, we would say it was foolish for him to go out and purchase a jackhammer. You see, there has to be some wisdom. And then also, I don't believe that a church should own or have a tool in its toolbox that does not fit with its mission. You know, a business, maybe that's a bagel shop, is probably not going to be in business very long if it goes out and buys a harvesting combine. Now, you can make a connection between the harvesting combine and the wheat that's in the bagel, but there's really no legitimate connection in those things. So let's look then at the issues of generic authority and ownership. May a congregation own certain things? Well, yes, I believe they can. In fact, I believe that they can own a building. I believe they can own what it takes to carry out the mission. But now, let's think about some things that maybe the religious world is doing that we would disagree with. Can a church or a congregation own and operate a hotel? Well, let's go back and apply those principles that we've learned. Is it something that would, be necessary for evangelism, edification, the needy saints, or assembly? Well, no. You see, even when we think of hospitality and lodging stranger, in the New Testament, that was a home work. And so, may a church own a hotel or operate a hotel? Well, no, because that's the wrong mission and the wrong tool. Well, may a church or a congregation own or operate a bowling alley? Well, we have to ask the same questions. Is a bowling alley necessary for evangelism? Now, I'm not arguing whether we can talk at a bowling alley about the gospel. I'm arguing, does the church own that? Can they own that? Is that something that is required to fulfill any of the four needs or tasks that they have been given to do? Well, certainly not. And so I think all of us would agree that there are certain things that a church perhaps might purchase, but which would be a violation of not only Scripture directly, but also would be a violation of the goals and the work that the Lord has given them to do. Well, let's just move on. What about a gymnasium? Is a gym necessary or authorized for the church's work? Well, no. It is not something that, again, is a command or an example or would even help us in evangelizing or edifying or taking care of the four basic needs of the church. In fact, it would be destructive and distractive from that. What about, again, a pizza parlor? Well, the same is true with this as opposed to any of these other issues. What about a coffee shop? Again, it's not something, it's not a tool that is needed for evangelism, edification, assembly of the saints, or taking care of the needy saints. Again, and I might point out that hospitality was a function of the home. And so to own many of these things would be the wrong mission, and it would be the wrong tool as well. Well, of course, soup kitchens, the same logic. And for time's sake, I'll let you fill in the blanks. But we come now to one of the things that was asked to be discussed, and that is, what about a church kitchen? Now, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't like this topic because my conclusions lead me to a place where I don't want to go. And my conclusions are uncomfortable for me. And so in my mind, there's still a lot of consternation and working out of the particulars of all of this. But I think we have to, again, keep in mind that we're trying to be people of the book. And at the end of the study, you may totally disagree with me, and that's okay. There's nothing personal here. It's something that we're trying to work through together. And it's tough because we live in a context religiously where people are doing so much that no matter what the Church of Christ does, it looks pretty pathetic and small in the big picture. But again, is there authority for a kitchen? Is there authority for these things? Well, I think we'd have to ask maybe back up and apply the rules. Is there ever a time? And again, if you can answer yes, that's fine. Or if you answer no, that's fine too. I'm not trying to lead you. But is there ever a time in evangelism when we might need a church kitchen? Is there ever a time in edification that we might need a church kitchen? Now, if you can answer that yes, then that would fall under generic authority. Is there ever a time in taking care of the needy saints that we need this thing or the assembly? Is there ever a time? And so we have to, no matter how it hurts us or whatever, apply these things to the principles of the mission and work of the church and, of course, what the church can own and operate. Now, you get all of these questions. I've got 6 minutes left, so I'm going to really try to talk fast. I want to, first of all, discuss when we're discussing church kitchens. And by the way, that was specifically given to me as a task to tackle. The issue is not this. The issue is not whether Christians can eat in a meeting house. That is not the issue. I don't believe there's anything wrong with eating in a certain structure. The issue is not whether churches, Christians rather, can get together and have a potluck. So what is the issue? Well, the issue is ownership. The issue is what we own, does it fall under either directly or indirectly the work and mission of the church? And if we can justify that, and I'm not saying that every area is going to be the same. There may be areas where one thing is justified and another area where it is not justified because the needs and the tenor of the land is different. So the issue is not whether we can be together and eat together or eat in a building. That is not the issue scripturally. Well, someone says, well, what about donating things to the church? Well, that's pretty much what we've always done back home, you know, the congregation, I'll be honest with you, where I have for 50 years, I guess it's had a donated refrigerator and a little stove. We have potlucks there, whatever. But now the question really is, again, what about the ownership of that? And I'm struggling with this. Once donated, who takes care of it? Now, I think we could split hairs, and I think we could get ridiculously legalist, perhaps, and I'm trying to use that word in the truest sense, by saying, you know, well, we have a stove, but who pays for the electricity? I think we can get ridiculous in our discussion, but nonetheless, we don't want to saddle the church with things that would require its monies to be used for that which is not its mission. So even if we come to the point where we say something can be donated to the church out of the pockets of the individuals, we still have to look down the road a little bit to determine whether that is a wise decision. So wisdom obviously plays a part even in these generically authorized decisions. Again, someone's asked me sometimes, well, what about a church that's going to build a building? Maybe they can build a building for $300,000. It doesn't have a kitchen. But they can buy a used building for $250,000 that has a kitchen. Well, I believe that a lot of these issues have to be settled on a congregational level. And the issue really, again, is not how much something costs, although there is the issue of stewardship. We obviously want to use the Lord's money wisely. And if I seem like I'm riding the fence here, I don't know how to get off of it. But nonetheless, we have to use the Lord's money wisely. But really, the issue is not so much the cost of something, but the issue is the ownership of that thing. What is the church authorized to own? Now, I'll throw this in, and I'm running out of time, but I think this is important. You know, one of the problems we have today is that the church in our culture is a legal entity. First century, that wouldn't have been the case. You know, you go overseas and the government wants you to register the church. Well, that wouldn't have happened in the first century, as far as I know. You know, the church was a grassroots group of individuals who assemble for edification, for worship, to take care of their own, to evangelize. You wouldn't have had these issues sometimes that we fall into today about church ownership of property because they weren't a legal entity. But nonetheless, what can a church own? And I think that really is the decision or the question. And along the way, we need to ask, how is this going to impact the congregation? You know, just because something is not necessarily wrong, maybe it violates the conscience of someone in the midst. Maybe it would portray the wrong image to the community. We discussed the other night, Richard and I did, what if someone donated a huge gymnasium to the church? Well, that's a privately donated thing, but what message does it send? And so, again, we have to be wise. I do believe that some of this falls to congregational autonomy, and I believe that a congregation will ultimately give account for the way it uses the Lord's money. It is indeed an issue of stewardship. Well, in my last minute and 52 seconds left, I want to talk about, again, some of these last issues. Number one, what about fancy buildings? That was given me specifically. Fancy is a relative term. And again, not to pick on anybody, but I've got two churches from Africa and two churches from America. Both of those, I suppose, fit nicely in the communities where they are. But yet, they're worlds apart, literally and figuratively. So, fancy is very relative, and what may work for one area, there's no one mold, may not work for another area. Now, mistakes that we make in the Lord's money. Well, let me just, first of all, I think the biggest one is classifying needy saint too broadly. I don't believe that, again, we are authorized to help people that won't help themselves. I don't believe that because somebody can't pay their cable bill, they end up being a needy saint. That's part of our welfare mentality that we have in this country and in our culture today. Clint DeFrance said, one must learn to live within his means until he no longer has the means to live. And I believe that's exactly right. A congregation can make a mistake by hoarding its funds. The Lord doesn't want money when he comes back. He wants souls. Also, making commitments that membership cannot fulfill. We don't want to get ourselves in over our heads budget-wise when the congregation may be dwindling or dying or moving away. Owning unnecessary property. Again, if there's something that is used and needs to be used for the work and function of the church, then let's own it. Let's do it. Let's take care of it. Let's use it. But to own things that later become a headache or a maintenance problem or an albatross around our neck is not only, I believe, unscriptural, but it's simply unnecessary. And of course, especially in foreign work, sometimes in Tanzania and all, you have to be real careful because people begin to look at the church as the headquarters and the mission, and you get into all kinds of a mess by simply the ownership of certain properties. So, in conclusion, I believe we have to use wisdom. I believe we have to use Scripture, first of all. But I believe if something does not fall underneath those four basic categories, either specifically or generically, then we need to at least think very carefully about owning those particular things. Well, that wasn't my entire presentation, but like I said, if I hadn't added those 8 slides over the last 2 days, we would have been done. But thank you very much.